Today's episode of Ariel Helwani's MMA show contains explicit language that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Back in your life on this Wednesday, October 2nd, 2019. Hello again, everyone. I'm Ariel Helwani. Hope you're doing well. I missed you on Monday. I was off. It was Rosh Hashanah. I was in Montreal with my family. Felt weird not doing a show, especially coming off a very busy weekend in the world of mixed martial arts, the UFC in Copenhagen for the first time, Jared Cannonier defeating Jack Hermanson. What a performance that was. The return of Nicholas Dalby. Mark O. Madsen's amazing UFC debut. There was a lot there. Bellator on Saturday. The conclusion of the first round of their Bellator Featherweight Grand Prix. The draw. Bellator Dublin on Friday. A lot happened this weekend. And so I felt weird. I felt empty. I felt like I let you all down. But here I am on a Wednesday. And before we get into today's Wednesday show, I want to make a small announcement right off the top. So as you probably know, and as you probably noticed, this has been my schedule over the past few months, essentially since the beginning of 2019. On Mondays, I would do the Helwani show, the interview show, the show that you've been watching for the past 10 plus years. And then on Wednesdays, in addition to everything else, we were doing this MMA Reporters podcast. And initially that started when I was spending my Wednesdays in Bristol, Connecticut. I may be going a little too inside baseball here, but you know me, I'm an open book. I like to let you all in on what I'm doing and the psychology behind it all and the reasons behind it all. So let me just explain. So initially, early this year, I was doing the MMA Reporters because I was in Bristol on Wednesdays. I was in Bristol, Connecticut, ESPN HQ, aka on Mondays for my Monday show. And then I would come on Wednesdays for Ariel and the Bad Guy, which is on ESPN Plus. And then we decided to do this secondary podcast after we got rid of the post show, aka the Crust First show, where I still wanted to have a secondary show. So we decided to do the MMA Reporters on Wednesday as well. And that early on was essentially the old MMA beat where it would be me and two or three other MMA reporters in the same studio together, doing a roundtable-like show about the state of mixed martial arts. Well, a couple months into all that, around late February, early March, I was moved to New York City on Wednesdays. So I stayed in Bristol on Mondays for the Helwani show, moved to New York City on Wednesdays, and I think I mentioned on the first episode that I did from New York City on Wednesday that I was switching things up. I was still going to keep the MMA Reporters, but it would be more like, all right, me and one person for 20 minutes, then another person, kind of like a mini version of the Monday show, but MMA Reporters. Well, over time, I have felt like that show has really found its groove and its niche, but why be beholden to just MMA Reporters? There are times where I want to have other people on the Wednesday show, and it didn't really fit because the name of the show was the MMA Reporters. So in an effort to keep everything under the same umbrella, keep the brand consistent, if you will, this is just going to be another Helwani show. You get it? So Mondays, this is going to be the schedule. Monday, it'll be my regular Helwani show, 1 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, and that'll be on YouTube and Twitter and all those places. The usual stuff. Nothing's changing there, and then you can get the audio afterwards, of course, on the feed, wherever you get your podcast. Tuesday, we've always been doing for the past 10 or so months, since January, we've been doing a one-hour version of that show, and that would air on ESPN2, usually around midnight Eastern. That's Tuesday night. Wednesday, it will be another Helwani show podcast. This will be just audio only, so nothing really is going to change as far as when you're getting this show and the topics and really the guests, because it will be slanted towards the media personalities and talking about, you know, the topics of the week. Wednesdays, you'll get this. And you'll also get Ariel and the Bad Guy on pay-per-view weeks. You'll get a radio version of this show as well, usually on Saturdays. And we've got some other things in the works as well. So I just felt like, why not just call it all the Helwani show as opposed to having one random other show and, you know, being forced to just have a certain kind of guest on. As you'll see next week, we'll have a completely different kind of guest. And I like the flexibility. I like the opportunity to flex my muscles a little bit, get a little creative with the guests. I think this is going to be better. So don't get all up in arms. Don't get all, you know, hoity-toity. It's going to be the same thing. You see the music is the same. It's just going to be a Wednesday Helwani Show podcast as opposed to calling it the MMA Reporters, because I don't want to be handcuffed. I don't want to have to be in that little box that Diego Sanchez was talking about when I spoke to him back in July. All right. Hopefully that all made sense. Did that make sense, TST?
Made perfect sense to me. A little too long for my liking, but you made your point.
I'm sorry. You see? Again, TST, tight ship. We appreciate everyone who has written in some comments, who has posted reviews, who has voted on the page, whatever the heck you call it. I don't know what you kids call it these days. I'll get to some of those later in the program, but let me get to today's lineup. Later on, we're going to be waking up New York Rick. New York Rick is in Australia, and he's going to wake up at like 5 a.m. local time to do this show Thursday morning over there. He's there for UFC 243, so we'll get his perspective. He's been there for the last couple of days, so that'll be a lot of fun. Mid-portion of the show, we're going to talk to ESPN.com senior writer Ramona Shelburne, who I met for the first time at UFC 193, which was the last time the UFC held an event at Marvel Stadium. Back then it was known as Etihad Stadium. She was working on a story on Ronda Rousey. She became somewhat of a Ronda expert, if you will. So I thought it would be fun to reminisce with Ramona Shelburne on that experience and how the fight itself against Holly Holm completely changed the course of Ronda's history in the sport of mixed martial arts. So I'm looking forward to talking to her, first time she's been on this show. So you get what I'm saying? Not quite an MMA reporter, but we're starting to branch out, if you will. But let's go now to our first guest of the day. Old faithful, if you will. It wouldn't be a Wednesday show without Mark Raimondi. So let's say hello to Mark Raimondi, who's kind enough to squeeze us in today on a very busy Wednesday, I'm told. He leads things off on today's show. Mark, how are you?
Lashana Tova, Ariel.
Wow. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate that. That really means a lot. And the same to you. Umetuka, as they say. Scale of 1 to 10, Mark. How excited are you on this Wednesday afternoon? Let's break down the fourth wall here. I mean, I can't even imagine how excited you are on this Wednesday. Tell us, scale of 1 to 10. How excited are you?
I'm pretty excited. And you know me, I'm not the most excitable person usually, but it is a very, very big day for professional wrestling, Ariel. A very, very big day. All Elite Wrestling makes its premiere tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern on TNT, and it'll be going up against WWE NXT on USA Network. They're both two-hour shows. The wrestling war is back, Mr. Helwani. It's like the late 90s all over again when you and I were fervent fans of the medium. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm pretty pumped for it.
Here's the big question, Mark. Will we see something like this tonight?
He's cleaning house.
Wait, Luger's in there.
Lex Luger in the ring. Lex Luger.
He's humping Hogan.
In the ring.
He's humping Hogan.
Luger. Whoa, wait a minute.
What is it? War 3.
Mark, September 4th, 1995, Mall of America, Minneapolis, Minnesota, the first ever. Mm-hmm. WCW Nitro, Lex Luger shows up unannounced. No one knows. He was on a house show the night before for WWF, and then he shows up at WCW. Are we going to see something like that tonight? Is Kane Velasquez going to show up to AEW? I don't know. Is John Cena going to show? Tell us. What's going to happen? Should we be watching this?
I think they will have some surprises up their sleeves. I don't know what they will be, and I don't know what level. I don't think that. I mean, it's 2019 now, so I think a lot of people who are listening don't know or don't care about when Nitro premiered with Lex Luger, but we're talking about one of the top guys in WWF being on WWF TV like a day earlier, essentially, and then showing up on WCW television a day later, the competitor on a brand new show on TNT. It was a really, really big deal at the time. I don't know if there's anything like that. Also, I'll say this, Ariel, in the social media era, it's very hard to keep those things a secret. Whereas back in 1995, no one knew that Lex Luger was going to be there. I believe they hid him from everyone backstage. They had him like in a broom closet. They had like a thing over his head. No one could see, that it was Lex Luger at WCW. I don't think that is as easy to pull off in 2019 as it was back then.
I love the passion in which you talk about all this. Let's try to build that bridge to the world of MMA, because I could see the hardcores just getting all up in arms here. I could feel their presence. Is there a chance Cain Velasquez actually shows up on either WWE television or AEW television this week?
This week? Well, I don't know about this week, but could that happen in the future? 100%. Absolutely. I don't think, I'll say this, I don't believe, unless something has changed in the last few days since the last time I was in communication with my sources, I don't think Cain Velasquez is in Washington, D.C. today for AEW. Again, I don't know for sure. It could be. Things change. But I don't believe he'll be at the AEW show tonight. So that is probably not one of the surprises that AEW has, unless it is. I don't know. But could he be on one of those shows in the near future? I think he could be. I think that's a definite possibility. He is in talks with several wrestling promotions about a future in that business.
Considering the interest in him, and it apparently is very high, do you think he has fought his last MMA fight?
I honestly don't know. I still am. It's still up in the air as to what his future brings, because, again, as far as I know, nothing is down on paper with regards to him signing with a wrestling promotion, and he's still under contract with the UFC. I know that Cain Velasquez is a competitor. I know that, kind of like his good friend, his teammate Daniel Cormier, I'm sure he doesn't want to go out on that Francis Ngannou loss. Also, the UFC values Velasquez greatly. He is a big draw in Mexico City. He can headline pay-per-views down there. There's no one else like that that they have. So, and the UFC just opened up a performance institute, or they announced the construction of a performance institute in Mexico. So that is still a market they value greatly. I'm sure they want Velasquez back. And you know what? After his performances in AAA, the Mexican Lucha Libre promotion over the last few months, things are hot and heavy for him on the wrestling side too. Because like we just said, it's a war. Both sides are trying to. It's an arms race. Both sides are trying to get as much talent as they possibly can. And there are other players as well, New Japan Pro Wrestling, and perhaps some others. Of course, AAA is still in the discussions as well. So it's going to be very interesting the next few weeks and months.
I have a hard time believing the UFC is just going to say, like, oh, yeah, go ahead. You know, remember when Randy Couture tried to fight Fyodor, and I know this is MMA to MMA as opposed to what we're talking about right now, MMA to pro wrestling, but Cain still has some juice behind him. I feel like everyone is sort of ignoring the fact that he has a contract with the UFC, and the UFC is not just going to let him walk over to the world of pro wrestling, right?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that that is certainly a hurdle that I think has to be overcome before anything can really be achieved for him in that realm. There are ways around it. I mean, WWE lets Brock Lesnar fight. It's in his contract. He can do that, really as much as he wants if it fits their schedule, and then they work it out. Maybe something like that can be written into Cain Velasquez's contract. Of course, the UFC would have to grant him that opportunity. I mean, a world where he's doing both those things, WWE and the UFC, is not terrible for either places, in my opinion. I mean, I feel like it's only made Brock Lesnar a bigger star doing both. So maybe that's something that Cain Velasquez can rehabilitate his star a little bit after that loss to Ngannou. He can go to WWE, have a big program, become a bigger star there, go to UFC and headline a big event. I don't know. Just spitballing here, but I don't think that's completely out of the question. I think there's a lot of options.
Yes. All right. So it's an interesting time if you're a fan of pro wrestling. It's always fun when a new kid comes on the block. And shout out to our friends over at the Cheap Heat podcast, Peter Rosenberg. They're doing a great job of chronicling all of this. I'm just playing fake wrestling fan for this week and maybe next week as well. But I'm interested. I'll probably watch.
Are you going to watch All Elite Wrestling?
Yes.
Dynamite tonight?
Yes, I will be there watching at home. I will not be actually in the building at the the arena in, where is it, Washington, D.C., right? Capital One Center, I think they call it these days.
So you're not one of the big surprises.
Well, you know, if I was a big surprise, I wouldn't say it right here, right? I would say that I'd be at home watching it, and then I would show up, and they would say, Helwani was the third guy. Helwani was the third guy.
The third man.
Yes. So I'm looking forward to that. I didn't do a show on Monday, as I said at the top of this new episode of the Helwani Show. I don't know if you heard, but we're dropping the MMA reporters. We're just all under one umbrella. It's just one happy family. I think it makes a lot more sense. I could talk about it a little more, but I think TST's head is going to explode if I continue to talk about this. I didn't really get a chance to digest this past weekend. And so let me ask you this, putting you on the spot.
Yep.
Bellator Dublin, UFC Copenhagen, Bellator and Inglewood, which you were at. Who was the star of the weekend? A lot of people fought, a lot of impressive performances, a lot of big-time performances. Who stood out? Who was the MVP, pardon the pun, of this past weekend?
I would love to say Jared Cannonier, even though I was at Bellator on Saturday. I did watch pretty much that whole UFC Copenhagen card in the morning before heading over to Inglewood. Cannonier, as far as where he is in terms of rankings, contender, his stature in the middleweight division, I think no one quite changed their fortune quite like him. He knocked out a very, very tough Jack Hermanson. I thought he looked incredibly impressive, Ariel, in the first round especially. He fought off the takedowns, the suplexes from Hermanson. It looked like it was going to be a rout, the way that Hermanson was able to take him down. Cannonier got up every single time, and by the end of the first round, Hermanson was kind of worn out. And then Cannonier went out. Hermanson kind of shot in or went for a clinch, and Cannonier hit him with a beautiful short uppercut, and it was pretty much over from there. I mean, that was a really professional, a technical, a tactical performance by Cannonier, who, you know, he's been known for his knockout power and he's been known for his athleticism, but that was just a tremendous execution of a game plan and a tremendous tactical outing, I thought, for Cannonier. So I think he was the MVP of the weekend. Very impressive.
Yeah, some people have been asking me if he should leapfrog over Paulo Costa as the number one contender. I say we slow our roll just a little bit. I think Costa, especially if Adesanya wins on Saturday, should get that fight. I mean, there's heat there. They don't like each other. And even Costa versus Whitaker is a great fight. Cannonier's look good. I think he's front runner for maybe breakthrough fighter or most improved fighter of 2019. It's one of those things. Often they kind of blend into each other, but I didn't see this coming. I've been very impressed with him, especially considering he started as a heavyweight. I thought he didn't get enough credit for the win over Anderson Silva, and he certainly should get all the credit in the world for a win over Jack Hermanson. Marco Madsen, like I said, had a great debut in the UFC. I want to ask you about the Bellator Featherweight Grand Prix little show that they did, because we talked about it last week about, you know, me being a little confused. You know, it was not hard to follow, but I was wondering how it played out in the arena, because they did it right before the main event. And, you know, watching it at home, I was getting sleepy. I was getting tired. I was like, maybe we should do this after the Musasi-Machida fight. How did it play out in the arena? Do you think they did a good job with this?
I thought they did. I thought it was actually it worked out better than I thought it would. I too had concerns about what it would look like in arena, because you know how it goes, Ariel. It's late in the card. Fans are already several beers deep, and it's before the main event. You know, they people just want to get the fights going. And I sensed that immediately when it started, people were kind of like leaving to go to the concession stands. But I feel like by the end, they actually had gotten the crowd's attention, and there was actually interest. And the key, really, to me, the key were two things to the presentation. The big board, the big bracket, I think that was, if they didn't have that big bracket, no one could have followed what was going on in the arena. They had the big bracket on like the huge TV screen, the huge, if it was WWE, called it the Titantron. And if there was no big bracket, I can't imagine that the fans would have had any idea what the hell was going on, because people know what brackets are. They had the faces on the bracket, people choosing, you know, then faces going up. It was very easy to follow in that regard. And the other big key to me, Ariel, was our friend Mauro Ranallo. I thought he did a tremendous job with just the clarity of what was going on. He walked everyone through what was going on in the simplest way possible, and also in an entertaining way, because it's Mauro, and that's just what he does. So I thought those were the two big keys to what it was. They had that swerve at the end where they gave Patricio Pitbull the champ's choice. That no one knew was coming, none of the fighters knew was coming, where he could pretty much put himself anywhere in the bracket, not just the open space in the bracket. I thought it was pretty cool. I really did, and I had questions about how it would go, and I liked it. I thought it as far as the future of this tournament goes, it set up a number of very interesting storylines. And I thought it made the tournament a much richer layered process than it had been. And it was already pretty good.
Yeah, I feel like the tournament starts now. Like, going into it, there weren't a lot of stories going into those first fights, but now it feels like everyone is kind of connected to each other, and there's a bit of a backstory, and there's, you know, some drama between a few guys. Now it starts. I thought it did, you know, watching it on the East Coast, it dragged a little bit. I thought they maybe should have done it as a separate thing afterwards, but again, that was 9:45 p.m. Pacific time, so I didn't think it was as bad, and it didn't come across as stalling or dragging too long. And I agree 100% to tie this whole thing together. Morinao was phenomenal, as he usually is, and he's going to be on the NXT call this evening. So that's a nice little tie right there.
But by the end, Dariel, the fans were actually pretty enwrapped by who Patricio Pitbull would pick. And when he didn't pick Caldwell, they actually booed. So they were paying attention. Like they were actually invested in who Pitbull was going to pick, and they wanted him to go for Caldwell or McKee. He opted to go for Pedro Carvalho.
Wow. How about that? That's a good sign. All right, so that's going to play out over the next few months. Great job, as always, covering it, breaking it all down. I know you have to run to an interview now, so we shall let you go, Mark. Enjoy the evening. Enjoy the festivities. By the way, how are you going to watch? You going to watch split screen? You going to watch one and then tape the other? What are you going to do?
Probably going to watch AEW live and DVR NXT.
Wow. And then watch it after the fact? Watch it after the fact? Avoid spoilers? Avoid Twitter?
Probably won't. I'm terrible at avoiding spoilers, so probably not. I'm on Twitter all day, so.
So you're just going to watch it knowing what happened?
Yeah, which is fine. It's not to me. It's not the same thing as live sports, where if it gets spoiled, it's not as good. I still feel like the journey in pro wrestling matches is almost just as important as the destination.
Okay, all right, relax with the journey. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, there he is, Mark Raimondi of ESPN. I gave a shout out to our friends over at the Cheap Heat podcast. Also, want to give a shout out to our friends over at the Behind the Bets podcast. Got a huge weekend in the UFC ahead. We've also got NFL. We've got baseball playoffs. There's a lot going on. If you're into gambling, you got to listen to these guys. Check out ESPN's Behind the Bets podcast with Doug Kazarian. My guy, Doug Kazarian. Dougie Vegas. Does anyone call him Dougie Vegas? I feel like that's a name that needs to happen. Anywhere, you can get that podcast wherever you get your podcasts, like Google, Apple, ESPN app. You know the spots. Behind the Bets. Get it each and every week. If you're a gambling junkie, if you're someone that wants to get into the world of gambling, this is the podcast for you. All right, now let's turn our attention to this Saturday. The UFC is back in Melbourne, Australia. In fact, they're back in a specific stadium that I want to talk about here right now, because they have had multiple shows in Melbourne, but they've only been at this particular stadium once before. It's called Marvel Stadium today, but 4 years ago, it was called Etihad Stadium, and they went there for UFC 193. Ronda Rousey, who was the champion at the time, went up against Holly Holm. This was a big deal, and at the time, it was the highest attended event in UFC history, 56,000 plus, and this was at the height of Ronda Rousey. In case you forgot, this is how the evening ended.
Beautiful. Beautiful. She's hurt.
Ronda's in trouble.
She's hurt.
Hey,
oh! Holly looking to finish.
He's out.
Bantamweight champion of the world!
Oh my God!
Wow!
Unbelievable! What a performance by Holly Holm! Just an absolutely staggering performance by the challenger.
And so at the time, I was working for Fox Sports. I had the pleasure of covering that event in person. What a moment, one of the biggest upsets in UFC history. And I do believe it was at that event that I met ESPN superstar NBA reporter Ramona Shelburne, who was there chronicling the rise of Ronda Rousey. We met there, I think, for the very first time. And what a pleasure it is to have her on the program to reminisce about that moment and the rise and perhaps in MMA terms, fall of Ronda Rousey. Ramona, how are you? Thank you for doing this.
Good.
You're welcome. Well, I don't know if I'm the superstar, man. When I walk around with you at a UFC fight, I can barely get a word in because you just get mobbed by all the fight fans.
Well, I appreciate that, but it is an honor. I'm a huge fan of your work, and in particular, what you recently did, the 30 for 30 podcast on the rise and fall of Donald Sterling, aka the Sterling Affairs. We'll talk about that a little later on, but I want to talk about this moment and mm-hmm. your coverage of Ronda. Before we get to the Australia event, how did you first meet Ronda? Because you became sort of the Ronda reporter. She gave you access that no one really got. How did you first meet her and develop this relationship with her?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to remember how it all came together. I know that I covered her fight in Los Angeles. There was I think ESPNW reached out to me and said, hey, she's Ronda Rousey's fighting out there in LA. Could you cover it for us? And it was on her rise, right? It was the Kat Zingano fight. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think I'd seen the 9 for 9 on her, and I was interested. I'd heard of her. I was interested. I wasn't, you know, my husband and I are boxing fans, so I wasn't as into UFC at the time. I was more of a boxing fan, and so it was like I was like, okay, I've never covered UFC before. I don't really know the world, but like I'll go cover the fight. So I remember reading up on her. I was watching I watched the 9 for 9. I, you know, just to prep for the fight, because I think when you cover something that you're not as familiar with at first, you mostly just have to cover them as a person rather than, you know, try to pretend like you know exactly how the fight goes. You don't, I mean, like, I'm not going to pretend to be a UFC expert in terms of striking and kicking and judo and all of the technical stuff. But Ronda at that point was on the rise as a story and as a personality. And so I kind of came into it like I would, like a feature. Right? Like the way you would cover a feature. And it was definitely that fight in LA when I remember it was late in the card. I think she was the main event, right? You would have
yep.
been there.
UFC 184.
So it was late. And, I remember it took a long time to get to it. I was, you know, I watched all the other fights, and then I was kind of like, wow, it was late night. You know, it was already like maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night when she finally came on. And I heard the Joan Jett music come on, and it was like Bad Reputation. And then you see her walk in like she's the Terminator. And it was like, holy, can I cuss on your podcast? I'm not sure about
sure.
this, Ariel.
Go ahead.
You know, it was like, holy shit, what is this? Like, I've never seen it. Like, that kind of entrance and presence, and it like woke me up, you know? Like, it wasn't like I was bored. It was just a really long night, right? Like, and the other fights were good, but like nothing was, I don't remember anybody else on that card, but I do remember her coming out and just shockingly destroying Kat Zingano. And how many seconds was that fight?
14.
It was, yeah, 14 seconds. And it was like, oh my God, I waited all night for that. And it was 14 seconds. And it was like, yeah, it was good. It was like a good 14 seconds, right? Like and I always think of that scene in Gladiator where Russell Crowe's like, are you not entertained? And I was like, yeah, I'm entertained. That was something. And I remember going to the post-fight press conference, and listening to her talk. I think Holly was on that card too. I think she was like an early fight. It was maybe one of her first fights.
Yep.
And just kind of like seeing the way that, you know, Ronda would be up on at the press conference, and like nobody else, it was like there was just questions for Ronda. Like she just eclipsed everybody else on the podium except for Dana, right? It was just Dana and Ronda were the big stars. At least that was what it felt like as an outsider to the sports world, to the UFC world. And I, from that moment on, I was like, I'm in. Like whatever this is something that I need to cover. I need to try to understand. It's a phenomena. Right. It's not, to me, it was not about it was just a female story. I'd never heard a woman talk like that. I'd never heard a woman who talked like that be embraced by people. Usually when women talk the way Ronda does, like they're people don't like that. Mm-hmm. And they think she's cocky. They think she's whatever. And so I, you know, but because she was winning, because she was like Mike Tyson at that point, like she was, you know, walk in there and win in 14 seconds and boom. And I think I was just interested in all of it. It was a female story to me. It was I do like the fight game, right? So I really like boxing. I used to work out at Freddie Roach's gym in Hollywood. So it's like, I do like combat sports. And so I was like, you know what? I need to open my mind to the UFC. I need to like get into this a little bit more. And then I just started paying attention. And I think I must have known Brad Slater, her agent, just some other way. Like, he's just a guy around LA, and I knew him. I met him at the fight. Like, maybe I met him before, and then I met him at the fight then. And I just kept saying, like, I just want to write something great on her. I just think it's going to be, I think it's like just a hell of a story. And I wanted to get into it more. And I wasn't pretending to be a UFC journalist, right? Like, I was just like, this is a feature. This is a giant magazine story. And I think that's what led into everything. And we can peel back the curtain now, right? Of how that story came to be, which was ESPN was doing the year-end edition of the magazine, and it was Ideas of the Year. And I just said, like, this, whatever her version of femininity is, I feel like it's just caught in this cultural zeitgeist. It's this moment in time when there was a lot of women who were speaking out, who were talking differently, and they were being embraced and accepted. It was like, I'm trying to remember, there was a couple of female comics who were on their rise, like, was it Amy Poehler or something? Mm-hmm. It was like this moment in time, right? And so we were talking about, like, can I write a story about Rhonda, but really about this type of femininity at the time. And that's what led into the fight. And she was originally supposed to fight in January. So it was supposed to have nothing to do with, you know, going down to Australia with her, the Holly Holm thing. Like, but then Robbie Lawler got hurt, and, the fight was going to be in November, and it was like, oh, can we take a chance on doing this cover story on Rhonda as our year-end cover story? I think it was going to close right after Thanksgiving. And I was like, guys, she just won in 14 seconds. I mean, it's not like she's going to lose. We're going to be fine.
Yep. And in between that, by the way, she had the 34-second win over Betch Kohea, right? So, like, she was on a roll, like, two fights that lasted less than 60 seconds. So it seemed like a good bet.
Yeah. I mean, she was the invincible Rhonda. And, I mean, we were so cocky. Okay, I'm going to use that word. We tried to get the cover shoot done beforehand, and it just, like, with her training and the travel to Australia, etc., like, we couldn't get it scheduled in advance because, like, she just, you know, she was really focused on training, and I know she was having trouble with the weight cut before that fight. She was a little edgy. Like, there was a third fight in like 9 months, and we just couldn't quite get it scheduled. And so the plan was she was going to go down and do the fight. She's going to hang out for a couple of days. She's going to fly home. And we had the cover shoot scheduled for, like, she would land at LAX and then go over and shoot the cover right afterwards. And I remember saying to her and Brad Slater and all the, you know, everybody involved in this decision, like, dude, I mean, she is a fighter. I mean, what if she gets, like, a black eye or something, you know, in the fight? Like, is that, you know, this is her cover. And Rhonda said this to me. She goes, well, that'll be cool too. And I was like, all right. Wow. Like, if you don't care, then I don't care. Like, I mean, she's like, I'm a fighter. I might get hurt. And so I just was like, let's roll with it. And, obviously those plans did not work out.
Did you travel to Australia with her?
I was not on her flight. I was on the flight on the way home.
Okay.
There was this moment, as we were reporting this, like, I was very, I used to go over to, I think I started working, I started spending a lot of time with her in October. No, even earlier than that, September. It was about September. And, I'd spend a day, right. I remember meeting her at her house in Venice. And, like, the way we were going to do this access piece was like, okay, I'll just ride along with her and be a fly on the wall. And I'll be at the gym all the time watching her work out and observe and stuff. And then you just kind of ask questions here and there. And Rhonda, as you know, is such a pro with questions. Like, she doesn't mind people being around. She's just been in the fight game. So she's used to reporters being around, you know? They were always filming her for the behind the scenes stuff at the UFC too. And it was like, I was hardly the only person in the gym, right? It was like, there was maybe two or three people there at all times. She's kind of, it's almost like she's been on, you know, she's obviously been on a reality TV show, but it almost felt like that sometimes, like, you know, when people learn to relax around reporters and cameras and stuff. But I remember I rode with her one morning, and I'll never forget this because if I would have been a more experienced UFC journalist, I would have known something was wrong. Right. But I met her at her house in the morning, and, she was a little upset. And it was like, it was just because the weight wasn't coming off, right? Like, she was doing everything right diet-wise. And it just wasn't coming off. And I should have like realized that, right? Like when I tell you that, you're like, oh, you probably, that immediately rings a bell, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of was like, oh, is that normal? Like, you know, and she was stressed and she was talking to her, I forget his name now. She was talking to her fitness coach, the guy who does her diets.
Mike Dolce.
Yeah, there it is. Mike Dolce. God, I'm such a jerk that I forgot his name, right? He was a really good guy. So she was talking to him and he was like, well, have you been stressed? You know, this is probably just a result of having so many fights in such a short period of time. Like your body, you can't go through a weight cut like this, like so many times, you know, in a short period of time. Just keep doing what you're doing and don't stress out about it. The more you stress, the more the weight's going to hang on you. Like it's not going to, you're doing the right thing. It'll come off because it's just stress that's holding it on you. And so she was like in this state, like pretty early on, I want to say this was like September. And then I literally had this day with her that I think I must have met her at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. And then we drove from Santa Monica to Glendale to where she used to work out with Edmund and, Tarverdian. And it was like, you know, it was not too much traffic, but she'd made that drive a million times. Right. And, she goes, and so we get there and she works out and she's working hard. Like this was not just a walkthrough. These were hard workouts. And then at the end of it, she's got to very quickly get everything together, take a shower, get out the door because she's got some like shoot at the Fox lot. And it was, you know, for NFL Sunday, it was like a promo for the fight, but she was taping something for Fox and the NFL Sunday. And then after that, she was running over to shoot some promos that were going to air when I think it was FX or something. It was like at another location on the West Side. They were running Mr. and Mrs. Smith and she was going to be like, hi, I'm Ronda Rousey. Mm. And it was going to be during the commercials, right? Promoting the fight. And each of these things took like, you know, we were at the Fox lot for a couple hours. Like she was getting hair and makeup for an hour. Then it was like a couple hours of shooting. Then it was like drive across town or not, maybe it wasn't that far. They were both on the West Side, but it was, I remember sitting in traffic both times. Then she spent a couple hours shooting these promos for Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And then at the end of it, we had to drive down to, I feel like it was Gardena, to the Gracie gym where she was doing a nighttime workout. And like we would talk every time we were driving in the car, like this was the whole point of it. And you know, this is like, I don't have to interrupt your routine to be doing an interview. And I remember at one point saying to her, like, we're sitting on the 405. It's like, you know, a marathon day. And I'm like exhausted by this point and I'm not working out or anything. I'm just observing. Right. But I remember saying to her, I was like, hey, you know, if you just need to like have some chill time where we're not talking, like I can play on my phone for a little while and not talk and like let you just decompress for a second. Like if you just need that, do not feel offended. I'm not offended. Like, cause I mean, maybe I was even thinking that myself, right? Like we've been talking and doing this all day long and you just want to give some people some space sometimes. And I get to the end of the night. It's like, she's been going all day. It's like 10 o'clock at night. So we literally started at like 8 a.m. and then she's finishing at 10. And she offered me a ride back to her house even. Like, do you want to come back and you want to roll back with me to Venice? And cause that's, I had taken an Uber there. I just thought it was better to Uber and not feel like beholden to like have to come back to her house. Right. And I was like, oh no, you need some time, dude. Like you got to be sick of me by now. And she was like, oh, I'm used to it. And I was like, okay. Arrow, this was like every day for her. Mm. Every day was like that. And you wonder why, like the girl literally, like, why is the weight not coming off? Why was she just not at her best in that fight? Why did all that happen? Yes, there was obviously, you know, some skills that she never developed. There was obviously, she obviously didn't, you know, have a great plan or at least execute whatever plan she was supposed to do. But like, you can't keep that kind of schedule up in training and be doing that many things and being that many things to as many people as she was at the time and not have a fall. It's just too much.
And I don't know if you remember this, but she was sort of battling the MMA media leading up to that fight as well. She was upset that we were asking her questions about Travis Brown and about his history. Was she talking to you about that as well? Because we had never seen, like, we always had a great relationship with her, and I speak for all of us. Was she opening up to you, like, I'm sick of this, this is too much? She was?
Yeah, I remember at the time. I actually remember when, I think Travis came on your podcast, right?
Yes. In full disclosure, that was the end of my relationship with Ronda, unfortunately. I always had a great relationship with her, and then after that interview, I never talked to her again. That was the end. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, I remember her. I remember when that happened. I think I was like there that day, and it was. And we definitely talked about it. And our deal was like, when you're doing an access piece, like the whole point of it is to, people need to open up and forget that you're there. And so you just can't write stuff in real time. You have to save it for when your story is running, because if you start writing stuff in real time, you just kill the whole magazine story. But I remember having a conversation with like our news desk and Brett Okamoto and stuff of like, hey, like this is obviously crossing over here, right? Like most of the time it's fine on a magazine story, right? Like you're fine. But like when it does become headlines, like that definitely was headlines there. And I think we had like sort of an editorial call, and it was like, okay, I'm not going to contribute to direct quotes or anything like that. But obviously I have to be, I'm here, and like this is a big news story at the time. And I think Brett just handled everything. Like I think she put a statement out. Maybe they gave me the statement and I sent it to the news desk or something. But like it was very, that definitely added to the tension. And I remember a lot of what it was, Rhonda had felt like she had always given everyone a ton of access, and she'd always been so open with everybody that she felt very much like she had earned a level of like, of, and I don't know how to describe this, but she, cause I'm speaking for her, but like I'm trying to articulate her words. I think she felt like she had earned a level of like, you should just trust that I wouldn't be involved with somebody like who would beat up his girlfriend or his wife, right? Like you should just trust that. And I understand the sentiment, right? Because I think she felt like she had relationships with people and they should have just, but it's hard because it's like, okay, but even though you have earned that level of like, you know, people know her and that doesn't fit her personality, et cetera. Like she wasn't actually explaining it, right? She wasn't saying like obvious, if she would have just said that at the time, but it was also really complicated because she didn't want to be in this like victim shaming thing either. Like, you know, this had to play out legally. It had to play out with the UFC investigating this. They had to go through all of that. And, you know, I knew it, and because I had talked to her about it, and she had said everything at the time to me, which was her mom actually grilled Travis. Like I remember when this stuff came out, like her mom totally grilled him. He kind of came forward and told them about this. Hey, this is going on. Ask me anything. I think I wrote about this in my story, by the way. It's a few years ago, so I don't want to misquote people, but I'll refer back to that story. And her mom really like grilled him, and he was transparent with her, with Rhonda, with everybody. Like he answered all of their questions, and like they felt satisfied with his explanations for everything. But because there was a legal component to it. There was the UFC investigation that was going on. Like they just sort of couldn't speak publicly. And it's really hard to ask for understanding when people just flat out want answers. And so I think the way she rationalized it was, I'm going to talk to you about everything and how I'm feeling. And when you present it, it's all going to be in context, you know, in this magazine story that we were doing. And people will just have to wait for the answer. And that was the plan, right? That was her idea. And I mean, of course, I appreciated it because I'm going to have the exclusive and everything. But, and, you know, it's like, I'm not her, you know, public relations person. Like somebody else is supposed to say, or at least have that discussion of, well, can you even wait that long, right?
Right.
Like, can you even wait till after the fight? And, you know, I don't know if those, what those conversations were behind the scenes within her camp, because wasn't privy to that. I just kind of know what she told me of like, you know, I'm going to talk to you, but you know, I want you, you can't write this until after the fight. And it's like, that's the deal you make on a magazine story, right? Like on an access piece. But it was complicated, obviously, right? I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on at the time and behind the scenes. And, I think all of that stress. So like, I'm just describing to you the day that she had, and that was one day. And I think that was just about every day for her leading into the fight. The weight's not coming off. You have the issue with Travis that was sort of unresolved and hanging out there. And like, how much of your energy is going towards all of that? And how much of it is actually going towards preparing for the fight and getting yourself ready? And I just, you know, I look back on it, and it's like, because I was new to the world, like, I should have seen it coming. I mean, you always say that, right? Later, like, oh, I should have seen that coming.
Yep.
But you know, of course, because she lost, right? But I also had nothing, no frame of reference. I remember asking, she had a photographer named Eric who was always around, and he covered her in a lot of her fights. I definitely asked Mike Dolce about this, but like, nobody's going to say anything. They always say, yeah, she's tense before fights. She gets cagey, but like a lot of fighters do, right? You know, they get cagey, they get nervous. And so I didn't fly with her to Australia, because I felt like there needed to be some distance. Like, this is when it gets really close, but I definitely got there real early, and I went with her to some of the training sessions in Australia. She seemed fine.
Do you remember the face-off at the weigh-ins when she?
Oh yeah, that was weird.
That was weird, right? That's when everyone started to think like something doesn't seem right here. Did you feel the same? She was going after Holly, who's like universally beloved. Oh really?
Yeah, I didn't recognize her. I was like, because I had seen her, and this was like, this is how dramatic that weight cut was. Okay, so we, you know, we had a photographer who flew down there. His name was Nick Latham, and he, you know, he really wanted to get shots of her as she was doing the weight cut, because like that's so important. And so I was trying to keep my distance a little bit during that period, because it just wasn't something I needed for the story, right? But he really needed that, so I had negotiated for him to be able to shoot some. To be able to shoot her while she was in the bathtub as they were cutting weight. And so I just kind of went in there very briefly. And I remember seeing that process, and it was like, whoa, like that was intense. And so I saw her the day before. I think I was in a room when they were doing photo shoots, and she was doing a training session with Edmund, and it was really cool. It was like that Crown Hotel in Melbourne. And like she had a suite there with like all these windows. And so they had all the entire suite was like, they put all the mats down, and she was just doing a workout with, remember Justin Flores?
Yes.
Her judo instructor.
Yes.
And Edmund. And then there was I'm forgetting people's names now. There was a wrestling coach that she had. She did a pretty intense workout that day. And then like later that night is when she started the weight cut. So like I saw her when she looked like Rhonda to me. Okay. Then I saw her as she started the weight cut. And then I think we shot her pretty, it was like at night. And then the next day I saw her at the weigh-in, and I was like, is that Rhonda? Mm. Like, I didn't recognize her. Like, that's how much weight she lost. And, you know, Dolce was like very cool, you know, the whole time. Like, yeah, she's going to be great. She's doing great. You know, I was getting updates, kind of like how the weight cut was going, et cetera. I was shocked. She looked like skeletal to me. And like, I think she cut 19 pounds. Like it was a lot. And she just seemed like really cagey and really different. But again, I didn't have anything to compare it to. So the only people who could tell me if this was different than her normal time was, you know, Eric, the photographer, Edmund, Mike Dolce, people who had been there, Dustin Flores, like who'd been with her at other fights. And like, none of them were outwardly seeming alarmed. And I just kind of took it as like, okay, everybody gets a little tense. But I definitely remember the day of the fight. I thought we were going to have access the day of the fight. Like I was going to be able to go in the locker room, and I wasn't going to say anything, obviously, because she's pretty famously very quiet and like takes a nap and tries to relax before a fight. And then Edmund shut that down.
Mm.
And, you know, I was like, it's okay. I mean, it's kind of like, again, it was more for my photographer than for me. Cause like for me, it's, you know, I'm writing a narrative, right? And like there's so much scene already that I wasn't too worried about it, but it definitely was something that was like surprising because it was the first time they kind of cut something off. And, I remember afterwards, like I did go to the hospital with them, and I was talking to a lot of people in the, after she lost, like, that's when everybody kind of started to like say like, yeah, that was really a bad weight cut. That was really, she was really cagey. She was really like tense. And I just think everything hit her. Right. And she told me afterwards, like she, if you watch the fight back again, she comes in and you just felt the tension in the air. And it was like it was a different kind of feeling that I had when I watched her in LA. I watched her from LA from the skybox of Staples versus like ringside after having been immersed in their camp. And, you know, you just watch it differently, but it felt different when they all came into the ring. There was like a nervousness to it. And then she jumps, she gets in the ring, and she used to do this thing where she would like jump up and like stomp her feet. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And she landed weird. I remember just watch it again. She kind of lands weird. And she told me later, she's like, yeah, I think I sprained my ankle when I did that. Like she's like, I didn't feel steady on my feet, But she did look like Ronda again to me. She had obviously rehydrated and put some weight back on after the weight cut and after the face off. But, she just never felt right ever since she did that weight cut. I think looking back on it, like, we all should have known, right? That face off, the weight cut, all of it was really weird.
Well, this is something I've always wanted to ask you. What was that flight home like?
Oh,
did you actually speak to her on the flight? Were you next to her?
Yeah, I was in the same, I was on the same plane and I walked by a couple times. Okay, so this is like freaking weird. Okay, so after the fight, I remember, I had a really tight turnaround on the story regardless, right? So I had actually planned to stay in Australia for like, you know, a couple of days, like, okay, I'm going to go out with them when they celebrate it. Like, that was probably going to be the lead to the story. You know, it was like when she wins, she goes out and has chicken wings. Remember that? She always says that, right?
Yep.
And drinks cider and chicken wings, right? So, like, I was going to go to the whatever that celebration was. And then, you know, stay in Australia for 3 or 4 days and write the story because I couldn't really lose the time in transit. My deadline was coming up and we needed to get a draft in and the editors have to read it. So, I had a hotel booked actually for like a couple days in Melbourne to stay and write, and obviously had to cancel that because she was just gonna she was at the hospital for a day, and then they released her from the hospital and she didn't go back to the Crown. She went to another hotel because all of the paparazzi were hanging out at the Crown, like just trying to get a shot of her. And I remember being at the hospital that night. It was just really sad. Like that was the feeling I had. It was really sad. Everybody felt really bad for her because I think they, all of her, you know, her team, they all just felt like, God, she had the weight of the world on her shoulders and she carried it around and around and around. And then she just kept apologizing to everybody. Like everybody who came in to go see her, like her sister, you know, Edmund, Justin Flores, all those guys, she just kept apologizing. Like she's like, I'm sorry I let you down. And like, it's just like this really sad scene, right? Like, you know, she wasn't like, you know, the defiant Ronda. She was just like, she was just broken. Like that was the feeling I had and that everybody else had as they walked out. And it was like, okay, so then she goes to another hotel because they had to kind of hide her away, you know, she couldn't be like, she didn't want to be, you know, accosted as she went back into the hotel and she didn't want to be dealing with paparazzi. Her face was kind of messed up. Like she had, you know, her teeth, she had some teeth that were loose and she had, her face was kind of swollen. I wouldn't say it was like really grotesque or anything. It was just a little swollen. But she didn't feel good. I know she was on painkillers. Like you definitely don't want to face the press like that. And, you know, she got really knocked out if you watch it again. Right. And, so we got to the airport and like, I remember like they had set it up where nobody saw her. Like, I can't believe like they got on that flight. There's only like a couple of direct flights from Melbourne to LA every day. Like how did they not figure which one she was going to be on? It wasn't really that hard. Right. But we went to the, airport lounge and I remember it was like, she just kind of hit her face with her hair. And Travis was just like, just arm around her. Nobody's going to get anywhere near my woman. And like totally protective of her the entire time. And then we went to the, she like went through airport security. Like nobody saw her.
Wow.
Like I was following right behind. And if they saw her, they didn't know it was her because nobody stopped her. And then we went to the Qantas, lounge. Like, you know, you fly business class, you go to the lounge. So she just kind of sat in the corner of the lounge. I think she was just like sleeping a lot of the time. And then they had seats in business class. And like, it was like, you could have just like walked by her. Like literally, she was just like on the aisle.
Wow.
You know, and I think I said hello to her, but she seemed like really like, didn't want to talk to anyone. She seemed like she was on painkillers and like not in a place where she could talk. Like and she says later that she was like, she wanted to kill herself. Like I actually believe her when she says that. Cause like, that's the state she looked like she was in. And you know, I mean, I think shattered, sad, apologizing to everyone, crying, like just feels like she just completely let the world down. Cause she felt that, like she really felt that feeling of like she was doing all this for women and femininity, and she like felt all that. She really believed in it. And so I think she just felt like she let everyone down. And I don't even know if she had any sense of the backlash at that moment, because she definitely did not have her phone on. She definitely did not, check social media for a minute. Like I know that, because I think she just like turned her phone off completely. And then lands at LAX. And like, when you're doing a story like this, like you stay close and like everybody else talks to her, like her, she had a personal assistant. Her name was Jessica, who was really good to deal with and everything. So like, I think Jessica just handled everything for her. Like she just kind of like dealt with like, how are you going to get the ride from the airport to your house? What are you going to do then? And then I remember she had like, they had that trip. Her and Travis had a trip planned. It's like supposed to be a celebratory trip, right?
Oh, no.
Like, remember how he liked to go hunting and stuff? And she was kind of all in that. And they actually still went on this trip. So she goes out to like, I forget where they went. I want to say it was like Texas or something. They like drove there. And she like drove in his truck to Texas. And she's like sad and broken. And like, I've got to go back to the story, okay? Because she has these amazing quotes about it. And she was just like, I think she was just like, like it was cold and windy and like they didn't catch anything they didn't get anything. And like some hunters came by and like gave them one of theirs because they wanted to bring home whatever they shot and have it for Thanksgiving. It was like right in and around Thanksgiving. And it was like, here's this turkey we shot. Like they took home somebody else's bird. Wow. Or something. And like, and I think she was like sick. Like she got really sick. So she was like having to go out and like either throw up or just something else the other end, you know, whatever it was, like out in the cold. And it was just like, it sounded like this awful, miserable trip, right? That was supposed to be celebratory. And then she came home and like, you know, was just wallowing in it, just absolutely broken. Like just it, it's the only way I can describe it. And I obviously like, what were we going to do with the story? And I argued that, you know, obviously we weren't doing that cover shoot, right?
Right.
But I argued that we didn't take Tom Brady off the cover of the magazine when they lost the Super Bowl, right?
Right.
Everything she had done in MMA and everything she had stood for is still valid. She just lost a fight, right? And in some ways, losing the fight and the ensuing backlash of her not touching gloves, over the stare down, over all of that, it was like, that was all part of it. That became now part of the story. That became something that like, so here's the rise of this female athlete who talks like Muhammad Ali and, you know, people love her swagger. But then when the second she stops being that person, that fall was swift, right? And she didn't make it any easier on herself either, right? Like she didn't, you know, speak post fight. Although I have to say this, like I was back there, you know, afterwards. Like, and I know like fighters, like it's a badge of honor, and I always advocate for fighters to speak after they lose, because like, dude, you just lost a fight. It's not, it's everybody loses in MMA except for like Khabib, right? But like, right. Everybody loses, right? Like you lost, yeah. But she couldn't really do a press conference. Like she got teeth knocked out and she was like concussed. Like she was really. Like, I don't think she could have done a press conference that night. Like, judging from what I saw at the hospital, and I mean, she was really out of it. Like, I don't even think she could have spoken.
This is fascinating insight, because I have been critical of the way she handled it, even going on SNL and not really being self-deprecating. That was a perfect opportunity to kind of poke fun at yourself. But it's great to get this insight. I feel like even going into the fact that they didn't make her speak to the media before the Amanda Nunes fight. She's the only fighter in UFC history who's ever been given this pass. And then, of course, didn't talk afterwards as well. It felt like going into that fight, she wasn't over the Holly fight.
No.
And I would go as far as to say, I don't know if she's still not over it yet.
No.
Like, I feel like it still affects her. And she really, you know, she did the one sit down with you before her WWE venture. But it still feels like the fact that she can't just come out and talk about it freely. Am I wrong for thinking that?
No, she can't. She's and she will never get over any of these losses. She's still not over losing in the Olympics. Like seriously, like that's just her character. She cannot accept losing. And when you bring it up, it's like she just doesn't want to talk. She shuts it down. She's like mad. And it's just a different kind of mindset. Like I don't really know how to explain it. It's obviously something I've tried to write about several times, but now that she's in the WWE, it doesn't feel as valid. Maybe one day I'll go back and have a real conversation with her about it, right? But Look, go back and read her book. Mm-hmm. Okay. She's not over losing the Olympics. when she lost in the Olympics, I mean, she got the bronze, right? When she lost in the Olympics, like, she went into a deep, dark hole for like 5 years, right? Like, that MMA basically helped pull her out of. I mean, that, the becoming a fighter and channeling that into being an MMA fighter is what got her over the depression of losing the Olympics. Okay. And I hate to use the term poor loser, like, cause we all have these ideas of what you should do when you lose. Like, it's like win with honor, lose with honor, you know? She's just never been good at that. Justin used to tell me, I think if you go back to the story, there's a quote from him in there, like, when she would lose at judo tournaments growing up, like, she was a wreck. She's like, she does not deal well with losing. And, you know, that's a fatal flaw, or maybe she would argue, like, why should anybody be good at losing? Like, that, if I was channeling Rhonda, I would say that.
Sounded like her.
Like, what should I just be, who's proud to be a good loser?
Yeah.
Is that something we should aspire to? Like, that's how she would answer that. And, like, I don't know, maybe that's how you're a great winner, but, like, it doesn't go over well. And, like, I remember doing that. I covered the Amanda Nunes fight too. And I remember I spent a lot of time with her before that. It wasn't one sit down. I was up at the cabin in Big Bear. I was in I went to her training camp in Glendale. We spent a lot of time together talking, and I think her feeling was like, she's always been a person who's like very loyal to whoever's loyal to her. Right. But like, if you cross her, as you found out, right? Like, she didn't like that interview you did with Travis or whatever it was. That's it. And, I don't know. So on some level, I respect that, right? Like, people who have that code. On the other level, I just don't think she did herself any favors before that fight against Amanda. Cause like, I kept feeling this, like, dude, it's just, you know, just go out there and do 10 minutes of it. You know, she did 10, you know, just say something. But I think she has this, I remember talking to her about it. Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you? Some of it was that loyalty thing. She felt like everybody turned on her. And I was like, it's not about turning on you. It's like their jobs to ask these questions. Like, I'm trying to explain this, you know, it's their job to cover you. Like, I'm covering you in a different way than they are. I'm writing magazine stories. Like, they're writing, you know, they're covering the sport day in and day out, you know? And it's, you know, it's this sort of with you or with against you kind of vibe that like, I understand that in combat sports, cause you're literally putting your life on the line. It's like, you just need people in your corner who have your back no matter what. Like, I get that, you know, I get it, but I also get that I see our side. I mean, I see what we do for a living. Right. And I don't know if she is, I don't think that's really what it is though. I really think it's this not accepting losing, never accepting losing. And, you know, that is now part of her story. That's part of her legacy. And I thought she was pretty good in explaining it to me. And I thought she got a lot of credit for doing the first story, right? Like, you know, she was just completely shattered, and I come over to her house, like, you know, after she got back and we did that story for the magazine, which, you know, I thought she was pretty raw in that interview, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Really raw. Like, I don't think she was ready to talk to anybody, but she did it. Because I think she understood she needed to say something, and she needed to explain, you know, give some kind of, you know, interview at that point. And like, I don't think she got enough credit for that interview, but I also think that maybe she got credit at the time, but then because she followed it up by not doing any interviews before the Nunes fight, like, it undid all that credit.
Yes.
And, there's also this component, and I don't want this to come across wrong, okay? So I'm going to be very careful in how I use my words, okay? Rhonda had become an international star. Like, she was not, she really had transcended MMA, right? She transcended UFC. She was a movie star. She was, you know, she could be on any magazine cover she wanted. People were just fascinated by her. She could go to the Emmys, the Oscars, the ESPYs, like any award show. She was like a breakthrough star. And so she was just kind of became more comfortable dealing with like the celebrity press than like the MMA press. And I actually kind of understand it, because I cover like LeBron James, right? Or Kobe or whatever it is, you know, and like, there's this, there's something that happens to you when you really transcend that world. And it's like, I just don't want to make it seem, you know, like I'm talking down to the MMA press. That's not what it is. It's just sort of like, it's just easier to deal with Ellen, right? It's just easier to deal with SNL. And like, it's also in her mind, in her world, it was like, she gave so much of herself to the MMA press for so many years that like, she felt like, okay, if I do one interview with Ellen, everybody's going to pick it up, right? If I do one interview with Ramona or with ESPN, everyone's going to run that. And like, maybe I don't need to do an interview with every single outlet. I can just do one or two and let them speak, let that be the record. I don't know. In some ways I get it. I don't think I agree with it from a PR strategy because obviously it ended up hurting her. But if she would have beat Amanda Nunes and then been the old Ronda, like, how do you think she would have been embraced afterwards?
Right. No,
would people have gotten over it?
I think the fans, forget about the media. I think the fans, the MMA community, felt like they helped in her rise, whether that's true or not, and that she turned their back on them.
Definitely.
And there's been a lot of fight. I mean, like, Conor still speaks to us from time to time, obviously not as often as he once did.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think part of that is she didn't like that we were we were covering her a lot more regularly than these people. Ellen isn't asking about Travis Brown or, you know, the loss to Holly like we might ask about it. So there's a part of me that feels like she didn't age well in the sport and she turned her back on the sport. I will admit it. I mean, we're going off on a whole other tangent. I don't think the way she handled the Travis Brown situation with me was the right way to handle it, especially with what she did behind the scenes. But that's neither here nor there at this point. I just think that when you lose, it's not that big of a deal. Like you said, you talk about it. And in this sport, more often than not, if you talk about a loss openly and freely, you actually become a bigger star than maybe you would have become after a win. Like, look at Conor, how he talked about the Nate Diaz loss, and we've seen this time and again. So I feel like she brought this upon herself, and she just made it out to be this whole bigger deal than it had to be. But again, that's what made her, and that's what, you know, helped her become the superstar that she became. That was her drive. What I want to know is, do you still talk to her? Like, do you still have obviously there's nothing to really cover as far as an MMA concern, but are you still close?
I don't know if we're close, but I'm still in touch.
Okay.
You know, exchange messages here and there.
You think she ever fights again?
No.
Crazy. Do you think she wrestles again?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Look, this is another side of this. I mean, I think her body was wrecked. Like, I mean, she had knee surgeries. She had I remember training for the Nunes fight, like she couldn't run. She had like no cartilage in her knee or something. Like she couldn't do that kind of training. Like she had to do a different kind of cardio. I mean, I just think her body was done. She'd been in judo forever. She'd been in MMA forever. Like she was like that. It just takes a really big toll on your body to do everything. I think wrestling was just really fun for her. That she really loves doing it. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of time away from home. Like they're constantly on the road. So it's a different kind of work, you know, than training. But like, I don't know. I don't know what it's like to put my body on the line, to put my life on the line. I don't know what it's like to get in the octagon, right? Like, do you?
No.
I mean, I cover people who do, and I have utmost respect for somebody who does that, right? But I can't in good conscience say like, you should keep doing that for a long time. Like the life, you know, span of a fighter, right? In that world, when you're putting yourself out there, taking that kind of punishment. I mean, like, dude, she took a lot of punishment in both those fights. You know, people forget like that when she lost to Holly, like I think she was knocked out on her feet with that first punch. Like I remember watching that really close and like Holly got her I feel like it was a right, because, you know, I think she got her really crispy, like right on the nose, right on the forehead with a right, like that Ronda just didn't see coming. And she was stunned. Like she was out. I was like, oh my God, she's wobbled. And it was really early in that fight and she kept going, but it was almost like a bull, like that saw red. Like it was just like, oh, she just like blew her out. I'm pretty sure she was knocked out on her feet for a second. And then she kept fighting and she kept trying things, and like she almost had Holly a couple of times, but like we forget that was a 2-round fight, and like she took a lot of punishment in there, and like I'll give her a lot of credit for that. She kept going. Like she didn't just take one hit and then, you know, go down. Like she fought pretty hard there. And then the Nunes fight, obviously you remember when that happened. Just, yeah. That was fast.
She was a shell of her former self in that fight. Like, it never seemed like she actually even arrived to Las Vegas, to be honest. And then talking to us didn't help either.
Yeah, not talking. Well, I mean, I was talking to her the whole time. I remember that. And she seemed okay. She seemed like cagey. She seemed kind of like she was channeling all that. She was actually enjoying the sport of not talking to the media, because I think she thought it was making the fight bigger. She was like enjoying playing the heel. Like, for her, that was a heel turn.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? Like, it was like a, you know, the more you want to talk to me, the more I'm not going to talk to you. Like, and it gave her tremendous power. It actually built the fight up quite a bit, right? It was like,
well, that in itself became a story, right? Because
that became
never
the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then if she would have actually come and talked to you, like, it would have dispelled it all, right? So, like, she's a pretty smart, savvy marketer. I just don't know if you can agree or disagree with that choice. I personally just thought it was, like, needless. Like, it would have been a big fight no matter what.
Sure.
Like, you didn't need to do that. Like, it was your comeback fight, you know, and everybody would have watched anyway. But that was the rationale. And then I think there was a defiance, you know, there was a defiance to it as well. But, like, I remember that Nunes fight. It was different than the Holly fight, right? Because with Holly, like, she got knocked out on her feet basically and just kept going and pushed through it. Like, with Amanda, it was like, she got hit once and it was like everything came flooding back and she just kind of faded. Like, that was it. And, you know, that happens in fighting, right? That happens to fighters. Like, you get knocked out once and they're never the same. You don't know how somebody's going to respond after a knockout. And I don't pretend to judge, because, like, I've just never been in that position. I've had failures in my life and I've had embarrassments, but, like, nothing on that stage and nothing like that. So, all I can do as a writer is just, like, try to cover it, chronicle it, et cetera. I give her credit in the sense that, like, whether you agree with how she dealt with it or not, like, she did pick herself back up and go have a whole other career in WWE, where she became, like, one of the most famous wrestlers in the world, and people really enjoyed that. Like, she did allow them to make fun of her losing.
Yeah, too. Oh, yeah, definitely. Becky Lynch, like, and so, bringing, like, that up, that was fascinating.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it was good. I mean, it was like, she wasn't, she kind of did a little bit with SNL, not that much, just a little. But then she really did it. She really let him have at her when she was in wrestling. And, like, I was like, oh, that was good. That was like, okay, we're getting somewhere. But, like, think about this. Like, it probably took her like 5 years to get over the loss in the Olympics. I mean, it hasn't been that long. It's been like 4 years since Australia.
Well, I have to say, if there's a soul out there that isn't familiar with your work, I don't think, especially someone like myself who adores basketball as well, this is a perfect blend of those two worlds. I think you get a sense for the kind of storyteller that you are from this appearance right here. So, unfortunately, we're out of time. I had a lot more to ask you about, but we were out of time. But I just want to tell people, if you are liking what you are hearing, you must, and if you haven't heard it yet, if you're one of the few that haven't heard it yet, you must download and listen to the Sterling Affairs 30 for 30 podcast. This was phenomenal work. Really, tremendous storytelling, tremendous journalism, the ups and downs, the work that you guys did to try to tell this story the right way, but the rise and fall of the former Clippers owner, Donald Sterling. Kudos to you and the entire team. I know how hard it is to put something like that together and how much work you guys put into it. I really can't vouch for it enough. So if anyone is interested, look, if you're not even interested in basketball, if you're just interested in journalism or just a life story, one of these serial podcasts, if you will, do yourself a favor and download the Sterling Affairs 30 for 30 podcast. This has been so much fun, Ramona. I really appreciate the look back at UFC 193 and the rise of Ronda and everything that happened afterwards. Keep up the great work. You're doing phenomenal stuff on the NBA side. You don't need to hear that from me, but I'm a big fan. It was great to have you on the show today.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Can I say one last thing before
you
go?
Sure, absolutely.
So the one thing that I always feel, and this is something that I've talked to Ronda about a lot, okay, is, and I think you probably feel this having covered her, everybody in the UFC probably feels this having covered her. What she did in the UFC still stands. Like, no matter how it ended, I hope we can get to a place where what she actually did as a fighter on, you know, building the women's division, actually starting the women's division, right? Starting the whole thing with Dana, and building herself into this, like, gigantic superstar. And then building, and then the things she said, that feminism she articulated, like, that's still there. That still exists. And I think a lot of the negativity that followed the way she lost, I think one day, and I hope maybe one day I'll write this story, I think one day we'll understand, and maybe she can even acknowledge this as well. I think she was just ashamed mm-hmm. and couldn't really, and didn't really want to say that. I think she really, like, go back to the being at the hospital and she's apologizing to everyone. That was her real true feelings. Like, she was just a broken person and ashamed that she let everyone down. And, like, I think I can understand why you don't want to, like, wallow in that or talk about that a lot. But I think one day she will. I do, because she did eventually with the Olympics loss. It just takes a long time. But I hope that someday she gets there, because all she did was lose a fight.
Yep. And what happened at UFC 193 should not take away, as you just said,
yeah,
the impact that she had on the sport, the trailblazer that she was, the pioneer that she was. She yeah. was a whirlwind. It was so much fun to cover those Strikeforce fights and the early UFC fights.
Yeah,
that was some of the most fun that I've ever had covering the sport of mixed martial arts. And hopefully at some point she can re-embrace the sport and the sport can re-embrace her, and that we can all just forget about this, because they were just two losses and really just one loss. The best fighters in the world were about to have Nate Diaz and Jorge Masvidal fight at Madison Square Garden. They have double-digit losses each. It's not that big of a deal. Life goes on. Very well said on your part. I couldn't agree more. And, again, great job chronicling her during that period and then everything that happened afterwards. And good luck this season with the NBA. We'll be watching. It's an interesting time, I would say, being a sports writer, an NBA writer in Los Angeles. I don't think that that's a hot take. So I'm looking forward to reading your coverage and watching it as well.
Look, it's been a long time since I had some relevant teams here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
So I'm very excited that I don't have to travel as much. Like, I have a one-year-old son. This is actually his birthday today. I'm really excited that I don't have to
be
on the road.
Yes.
Because I have two really good teams in L.A. now.
Enjoy it.
Thanks.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much. Ramona Shelburne, the ESPN.com NBA writer, a legend here at ESPN. Great to get her insight on Ronda Rousey and everything that happened leading up to UFC 193 and, of course, post UFC 193 as well. That was absolutely fascinating stuff. I loved it. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. All right, before we get to New York Rick, who is joining us all the way from Melbourne, Australia, let me tell you about my good friends over at the Dollar Shave Club. When I talk about Dollar Shave Club, I can't stress enough the quality of their products. They've spent, oh, wow, look at this, TSD with actual music that is tied to the place where we're having a fight this weekend. This is what I call listening to the criticism and then responding to said criticism. This is very culturally appropriate music, TST. Job well done. Two extra stars for you. Anyway, my friends over at Dollar Shave Club, I'd love to know the name of the song. They've spent years developing, crafting, refining everything. They have everything I use to look and feel and smell my best, because guess what? I actually use these guys. I love them. I use them today. Everywhere, my neck, my face, I use these guys. They're phenomenal. You name it, they have it, and I use it. I've been a Dollar Shave Club member for the past 5 or so years. Even dating back to the MMA Hour days, love the razors. I have sensitive skin. They are perfect. And as amazing as their shave stuff is, Dollar Shave Club is actually a lot more than razors. They've got you covered from head to toe. They have everything you need to shower, shave, style your hair, brush your teeth, and yes, even clean those other parts of your body. Dollar Shave Club can keep you automatically stocked up on all the products you use. You get what you want whenever you need it, whether that's once a month or a few times a year. I never have to waste time at a store wondering if what I'm getting is any good, because as a Dollar Shave Club member, I know what I'm getting is the highest quality. And right now, you can put the quality of Dollar Shave Club's products to the test using their Ultimate Shave Starter Set. It has basically everything you need for an amazing shave. The Executive Razor, Shave Butter, Prep Scrub, and Post Shave Do. The best part is you can try it for just $5. And after that, the restock box ships regularly sized products at regular prices. That's it. Get your ultimate starter set for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/Helwani. That's dollarshaveclub.com/Helwani. Great job, TST. All right. Let's go down under. We've been keeping him waiting, but I think he's standing by. New York Rick joining us. When we first met, I was the one traveling the world, and he was the one staying back. Now he's the one traveling the world, and I'm the one staying back. New York Rick, good day.
Good day, mate. My, how the tables have turned.
Yes. It is 5:45 a.m. on Thursday morning over there in Melbourne. When did you get there?
I got here
Tuesday morning local time at roughly actually the same time. So I've been on the ground for about 48 hours now.
First time in Australia?
First time in Australia, yeah.
Early impressions?
Can only speak on Melbourne. And
sure. And by
fantastic.
The way, good job saying Melbourne and not Melbourne or Melbourne.
Listen, I pick these things up. Yep. I'm a man of the world.
Well done.
But Melbourne reminds me a ton of New York, so I feel at home and I really like it. I'm a big fan of Melbourne in the 48 hours I've been here.
Okay, so you've had enough time to, I think, take it all in, and we've heard about all the talk that this could be the biggest event in UFC history, highest attended. Of course, previously, highest attended was in Melbourne, same stadium, UFC 193. We just spoke about it, 56,000 plus. Do you get the sense that this is a big deal? I know you weren't at UFC 193, so I'm not asking you to compare, but you just get the sense that this is a big deal over there. This is a big event.
Yeah, I'm seeing the marketing materials everywhere. I'm hearing conversations about it, you know, in passing. It definitely feels like there's a buzz in the city. Now, again, I can't compare it to 193 because I wasn't here. But I do get the sense that come Sunday local time here, Sunday morning, all eyes will be on this fight.
Do you get the sense, is it possible that Izzy is a bigger star there than Australia's own Robert Whittaker?
That, I think, remains to be seen a little bit. We're going to have open workouts later today. So I think that will be the first kind of test of truly who is the crowd support behind, whether it's split, whether it's all for Robert, whether Izzy has somehow surpassed his popularity here in Australia. So I think we'll get our real true test of that today.
I'm also getting the sense that while they were hoping to break that 193 record, unless they paper it, I don't know if it's going to break that. I'm hearing it's still at the 40,000 range, and you'll probably get some late notice people come up. But I remember when we spoke to Adam Curley when this fight was first announced, the Australian reporter, this was a couple months ago, he had mentioned that this is a really big sporting weekend, that there's a lot of other things going on. And I feel like it will fall short. Maybe they'll paper it like they did WrestleMania 3 back in the day and say that they broke the record. But I'm not getting the sense that it's actually going to break that record legit. Are you hearing anything about this?
I haven't heard anything, you know, regarding that, but I think the strength of the card matters. You know, in this case, we're looking at what is ultimately, you know, a one to a little bit more fight card. Obviously, there's the local intrigue of having guys on the card from Australia and New Zealand. But the star power, let's say, you know, a Max versus Volkanovski fight would have really helped this card strength. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the main event is magnificent. I think this is exactly the place to have it. I think ultimately the crowd is going to be tremendous. But I feel like it could have used that one additional fight like a Max Holloway versus Alexander Volkanovski.
Yeah, that would have put it over the top for sure. Losing Holly Holm, I suspect, is a bit of a blow. Have you heard people talk about that? Because we just talked about how she became this superstar by beating Ronda Rousey in that same stadium 4 years ago. Do you feel like that has impacted the interest in the card at all?
Yeah, I've definitely, in people that I've been having conversations with, they've been mentioning that, you know, how disappointed they are that Holly Holm's not on the card. I do think that there is such a long time. There's such a big window between when that fight actually happened. The MMA landscape has shifted so drastically. Holly Holm isn't in the same position that she was then. So if we were looking at this card maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, rather than 4 years on, I think it would be a bigger deal. But certainly, you know, the magnitude of just a star of Holly Holm's caliber getting dropped from a card that was already very top heavy impacts it. But I do think that because, you know, Holly Holm is in such a different place in her career, it's not as impactful as if this had happened immediately after.
By the way, were you there when Adesanya met Paul Pierce?
I was not. We had just landed that day. So I wasn't privy to Paul Pierce and Adesanya getting along. But from what I've seen, it was an interesting scene.
Yes, I heard that he's there to, I think, promote the NBL, which is the basketball league in Australia, and that they thought Izzy would be a big fan of his. But in fact, Izzy never heard of him. But Paul Pierce heard of him and was excited. Paul Pierce was more excited to meet Israel Adesanya than Israel Adesanya was excited to meet him. How about that?
And I think, you know, if you follow Izzy on social media, if you know Izzy's personality, if you think about the worlds of fighting and anime and cartoons, that I don't know that Paul Pierce is somebody who shows up heavily in your rotation. So I'm not surprised at the fact that Israel doesn't know Paul Pierce, but I'm definitely glad the truth is a fan of Israel Adesanya.
I must say it warms my heart that you're there, because you were on the Izzy bandwagon with all due respect, you know, earlier than most. You were the one who was saying, this is a guy to watch. This is a guy I know from the Glory kickboxing days, even though it didn't end all that well over there. It feels right that you're there for his, you know, first official UFC title fight. I know you fought for the interim belt, but this feels like the first official one. Like it feels serendipitous. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, you know, he didn't light the world on fire at Glory Kickboxing, which is kind of the story of this. If you pay attention to it, he was a championship contender. He fought for the belt in an event in Los Angeles against a guy named Jason Wilnes, who was the champion at the time. There were many who would argue that were in attendance that day that he won that fight and would have been Glory champion, but he never achieved that. And I believe that was his last fight for Glory. To that point, he had been winning, you know, unanimous decisions, but not this phenom that people are seeing now in the MMA world. I think this was something that was coming for him, the way he was training mixed martial arts alongside kickboxing. I think that this was always the path, and this was always where he was going to have his greatest success, because the differentiation between his level of striking and everybody else in MMA is vast. And I think people are starting to realize that if they haven't already, whereas in the kickboxing world, that is, you know, their bread and butter. That is what they are training full time. And he's going to have to compete against the very best in the world there. Now, certainly he's competing against the best mixed martial artists. I think Robert Whittaker is a tremendous one and a worthy champion, but the level of striking that he's able to have, as long as he can keep it on the feet, he's going to be in an advantageous position against almost anybody.
You didn't think he'd turn out to be this good in the UFC, right?
I don't know if I thought he'd be a champion this fast. Just the path that he's taken and how fast he's gotten to this title, especially after talking about, you know, needing rest after fight number one, fight number two, he seems to always kind of come back to the idea of needing rest. And still he's 6-0 in the UFC and fighting to unify the belt now. I'm not sure I predicted or thought it would have happened this fast. But I do think, as I said, the striking differential, if you're not somebody who follows the striking scene, if you're not somebody who watches boxing and watches kickboxing, you may not know how big a gap there really is between MMA striking and kickboxing striking. So, we're seeing that as long as, you know, Izzy can stay on the feet, he's going to be in every single fight.
I feel like the unspoken story, the elephant in the room right now as it pertains to this card, and especially that I want to get a sense for whether or not this is a real thing over there, is will the fight actually happen? Because the last two times that Robert Whittaker was scheduled to fight in Australia, the fight fell through. Now, the last time was way worse than two times ago, because that at least was several weeks prior, and they were able to find a replacement, and it ended up being Luke Rockhold versus Yoel Romero. This particular time, back in February that I'm talking about, you know, we recall he had the internal hernia, the collapsed bowel. He had to literally remove himself from the card hours before, on the morning of the card. You get the sense that maybe, I wonder if this is affecting ticket sales, that people don't want to actually pay until they are 100% certain this fight is going to happen, post weigh-ins, morning of, etc. Do you get the sense that people are worried about this, that this is a real thing that's adding to a lot of the anxiety building up to the event?
I certainly think if I was a fan who had purchased tickets last time, I would be wary. At the same time, if you had purchased tickets last time, you're looking at an event where Israel Adesanya built his star, you know, beating Anderson Silva. You're looking at the culmination of that. So I think that might be an interesting way to kind of spin it if you're trying to follow that story. That's the story that developed while Robert Whittaker was not able to compete in the headline event. As far as the conversation about it, I haven't heard anything about it. And I think it probably comes from a perspective of not wanting to put that bad juju into the air and not wanting to even consider that possibility. But from what I've seen all week, it seems like everything's on track.
So the fight opened Adesanya plus 105, Whittaker minus 135. Right this second, it's minus 125 for Israel Adesanya, minus 105 for Robert Whittaker. You know me, I'm not an expert at this stuff, but that means that Israel is now the favorite, right?
That does. It means Israel's a very small favorite. Both of those ranges are what I'd consider a pick 'em at this point, because they're going to fluctuate. There's going to be late money that comes in on Whitaker. There's going to be even later money that probably comes in on Adesanya again. This is a fight where people don't know where to go. And I think a lot of that is A, because as I said, Israel Adesanya's rise was so fast. People really don't know what to make of him. I think it's very hard when you have like a guy like a Conor McGregor or an Israel Adesanya who essentially, just continue to raise the bar, and do it so quickly. There's a sense of not knowing where the tests are. You know, we heard about Conor McGregor. Oh, wait till he faces a wrestler. And you just keep hearing, wait for that test and not really preparing for what the outcome could possibly be, that this is the real deal and they continue to ascend this way. And then on the other side of things, I think Whitaker, you know, what you mentioned, having not competed in such a long time. Now, it's definitely, I think, to his advantage in this scenario, even though, you know, it would seem counterintuitive to have not been sharpening your tools and not been in the cage. But after those wars that he had with Yoel Romero, I think the time off is probably the best thing that he could have done. So I think he'll be sharp and ready.
So what does the rest of the week look like? You got the open workouts later today. Is that in a cool spot? Are they doing anything different for that?
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. And we've got, after open workouts, we've got media. So we're gonna have the fighters available to us. And then weigh-ins, which we're going back to the old school. We're doing one morning weigh-in, no ceremonial, no early weigh-in, and then prepare for the ceremonial. It's all going to be one shot. When they step on the scale in the morning, that's going to be the weight.
Oh, that's always the weird thing about the Australia events, but because of the time difference, they just do the big to-do weigh-in and not the early one, and it's like the old days, right?
Yeah, the drama of you know, the scenario that we're talking about, whether everybody makes it to the scale, whether everybody makes it to fight night, is enhanced in the scenario because everything's happening in the morning. There's no evening, yes, drama. Everything isn't developing. We're knowing on Friday morning, rather Saturday morning, if everybody made weight, and we're knowing on Sunday morning if everybody's there to fight. So, it's going to be a lot more interesting than the typical fight card.
Now, here's the biggest question. Have you had the coffee yet?
I'm not a coffee drinker.
Come on. Really?
I know Australia is known for its coffee. Yes. I know, and everybody around me who's drinking coffee and who needs it because of handling the jet lag is loving it and enjoying the coffee. I'm okay, you know, trying my Vegemite, having some tea.
You had Vegemite? And,
I did. Yeah, it was delicious.
Get out of here, delicious. Now you're just being a hipster again. This is
tremendous.
This is worse. You know what? I should have asked Ramona Shelburne about your pick of Ronda Rousey comeback of the year.
You definitely should have.
Damn it. I blew that. No way you like Vegemite. There's no way.
Absolutely.
How did you eat it?
I welcome more. I spread it on a piece of bread down here in the hotel lobby for breakfast. It was tremendous.
Did you have the meat pie?
No, I have not had a meat pie.
Have you felt that there are a lot of flies? That's my big takeaway from Melbourne. I felt like there were too many flies.
It's funny you mentioned that. We had like a barbecue cookout the first night. We cooked some fish on the river. It was
look at you.
Very, very pleasant. It was very nice.
Wow.
And everybody who had been here in February mentioned, you know, the bugs, the mosquitoes, the flies. The weather is significantly colder now. We're in the, 50s, 60s range, Fahrenheit. And so we're definitely not, seeing bugs. No, everything's a little bit more chilly than would produce that scenario.
TST has a question for you. TST, take it away.
Yeah, my question is, what the hell is Vegemite?
It's a great question. I'm not sure. My understanding and general knowledge is that it's some kind of vegetable spread. It's very salty, but I'm not sure what the actual ingredients are. I was just told that I need to try it. And in fact, was recorded trying it my first time.
Oh my god!
And I have to say, it was quite favorable. You can see the video.
Where's the video?
I'll send it to you.
Okay,
I'll put it out, and you can put it out to the world.
This is what Wikipedia says Vegemite is. This is the grossest thing in the world. Grossest. There's nothing grosser on this planet. Vegemite is a thick black Australian food. Like just that alone, thick black Australian food spread made from leftover brewer's yeast extract with various vegetable and spice additives.
What?
It's the worst thing. There's never been anything grosser created on this planet. Vegemite is salty, slightly bitter, malty, and rich in glutamates. What the heck is that? Anyway, giving it an umami flavor similar to beef bouillon, it is Vegan, kosher, and halal.
There I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
Horrendous. You have to have the meat pies, by the way. Those are phenomenal.
Do you have a spot that you recommend?
No, just on the street. You know, just go to anyone. Tell them I sent you.
Okay. They know about Helwani.
Yes. And tell them about the new Helwani show that we're doing here. No more MMA reporters. We're dropping that. It's just all the Helwani show. One brand for the kids, start to finish, Monday through Sunday.
Look at you just taking over. I'm going to spread the word. You got the Facebook show, the People's show. MMA show.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I forgot about
that. Your rebranding.
Yeah. These are all the things I'm doing right Helwani now. Show. Monday Helwani show, 1 to 4:30. Then we've got the Tuesday TV version of the Helwani show. Then we've got Wednesday ESPN on Snap, which actually airs on Friday. Then we've got Ariel and the Bad Guy. We've got this Helwani show podcast. We've also got the People's MMA show, which also airs on Wednesdays on Facebook, yes?
Ish. Yeah.
And then also the other People's MMA show, which airs on Thursday-ish?
Ish.
Okay. And then sometimes the radio show. We're doing a lot of things, TSD, okay? It's not only about you.
I know. Listen, I'm loving everything that you're doing. You made me a fan.
Yes. In fact, New York Rick, TST told me that his favorite fighter is
Israel Adesanya.
Number one.
Can't wait for the fight this weekend.
Number one.
What a cap on this magnificent episode. How did you do it?
Wait, TSD, could you tell us who's your favorite fighter in the cage, but also favorite fighter out of the cage? Are you bold enough?
Oh, I'd love to. My favorite fighter in the cage is Adesanya. Love the way he fights. He's an aggressor, doesn't back down. And outside of the cage, it's got to be Colby. You have him on the show several Mondays a year, and it's so entertaining. And that's why I like him.
Wow. What a hot take. Yes. What a hot take.
I don't think it's hot at all. The guy's hilarious.
I respect it, Troy. What do you mean hilarious? This is all straight shooting.
I'm just saying, the guy's good TV.
Okay. I agree with you.
All right. We'll leave it at that. New York Rick, thank you very much. Thank you for doing this so early. Sorry we got you late. There was just a lot to cover because we didn't have a Monday show, so TST was kind enough to let me go a little longer. New era, new show name. Well, it's really the old show name, now becoming the new show name. But do your thing out there. Keep us posted. And also, please send us that video because I need to see you actually eating this.
I will send it to you later today. Thank you, my friend.
All right. There he is, New York Rick, joining us from all the way in Australia. It's kind of surreal for me that he's in Australia and I'm here because I was always away and he was back. But hey, that's how things go. All right. I told you at the top, we're taking questions on our Apple podcast page. I think that's what it's called now. And we appreciate everyone who subscribes and votes and also asks questions. So let's answer a couple of them here before we say goodbye, TST. What do you say?
All right. Sounds good. So Dan in Cleveland, he's rated the podcast 5 stars. And he wants to give you some love. He says, the host is one of the best minds in the sport, and this is a must-listen for MMA fans. His question is, does Stipe and Daniel Cormier get booked for Cleveland? As a Cleveland fan who was here for the first title defense, the fan support for the UFC was very strong, and we deserve another event, he says.
Okay, good question. It should. They're not even close to booking a venue, booking a location, booking a date. Stipe had the retina surgery, and honestly, it might take a while. It really might. We'll have to see if he recovers well from that, but I wouldn't bet on that happening anytime soon. I know that doesn't mesh with Daniel Cormier's current timeline, but they haven't even broached that subject. I'll tell you this much. I know DC would like for it to be in Cleveland. Yes, I said DC. He wants to go to enemy territory. We'll see if they get it done, but right now, too soon to say.
Dan in Cleveland also has another question. This is for me. So he says, I want to learn more about screen-free Saturday. Does the phone count? Can you still get calls or texts? What about email? The people need to know. All right, Dan. So first of all, it's screenless Saturday, so yes. Get your facts straight. And so this is my policy. So throughout the entire day, no TV, no email, no laptop, no computer, no phone. I do bring the phone in the fold at about 3 o'clock to answer my mother, to answer friends who are wondering what my presence is. And then as the night goes on, if I'm out at a bar or whatever and there's a game on, yes, I will look. But for the most of the day, I focus on just hanging out and not looking at my phone and just doing things.
Love it. One more?
Yes, one more. 5-star review from Tex 52820. Ariel, love the show. Keep up the good work. I really appreciate your willingness to reach out to all corners of the sport. It shows that you really care about the direction and future of the sport itself.
Thanks.
And his question, Ariel, is, do you have any recommendations or tips for someone trying to get into MMA journalism?
Be different. Look at the landscape. Look at what everyone else is doing and do something completely different. That's what I did many moons ago, around 13 or so years ago. Yeah, 13 or so years ago, I felt like there was a void in the interview department. I didn't like the way interviews were done on camera, on podcasts. The podcasts were very, very young back then. I mean, this is like the embryonic stages of podcasts, but like audio interviews, video interviews, I just felt like it was all being done kind of amateurish, to be honest. And I felt like there was a void there and that I could corner that market. So I was different. I dressed a little different. I got a microphone, a mic flag, a cameraman, and that's how it all started. So look at the landscape. Look what everyone's doing. Don't try to be an MMA journalist and write Fight Night recaps. There's a million people doing that. Try to be different. Find your niche. Do something that no one else is doing. That's my best piece of advice.
Yeah, Tex, and listen to your producers. Yes. And follow the time constraints, of course.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you for the reviews. Keep them coming, and we'll try to do this every week, so keep them coming.
All right, and how about this? We'll leave you with this. John Jones just tweeting moments ago to Israel Adesanya, keep convincing yourself that one day you'll be ready to face a boss like me. I'll keep convincing myself that when that day comes, I'll make you my absolute expletive. How about that? So that one just sort of looming on the horizon. John Jones, Israel Adesanya, could you imagine that? Could you imagine that fight? Adesanya saying earlier this week that he predicts it will happen 2021 at the new Raiders Stadium in Las Vegas. Actually, he said 2022. That was his prediction. He's been pretty good with predictions over the last couple of years, so we'll see. But for now, it's Whitaker, it's Adesanya, it's this Saturday, ESPN Plus pay-per-view. Also very much looking forward to Dan Hooker versus Ally Quinta. Kind of a two-fight card, if we're being honest, but those two fights are great, and I really think Whitaker Adesanya could be the fight of the year. Like, it has all the makings of the fight of the year. Oh, one more. John Jones just tweeted this, and I can see you're starting to sip your own Kool-Aid. I know how it feels. I've been there before. Only, I was around 23. Just don't become delusional, kid. F with a beast like me, and I will expose you. John Jones is all fired up for UFC 243. We're all fired up for UFC 243, and I'm fired up about this new era of the podcast. Just a bit of a change. Nothing huge. Don't get all crazy. Thank you very much to Mark Ramundi. Enjoy the wrestling tonight, Mark. Thank you very much to Ramona Shelburne. Again, check out the 30 for 30 podcast. The Sterling Affair is phenomenal. And thank you very much to New York Rick for waking up so very early. Thank you to TST. Thanks to all of you. I missed you. I'm back. I'll never leave again. Enjoy the fights. I'll talk to you next week.